Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Hey, tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, science, you know, some significant scientific principles based upon ageless wisdom. And also, we're going to be talking about limiting government based upon those principles. So I think it's going to be an interesting show because here is an application show that may have answers for some present-day issues. What are those issues that I've seen in the last week as an example? Well, questions like abortion, birth control in general, questions about gay marriage, and about what gay sexuality actually is and how, if anything, government should be involved with any of that, and a lot of other factors. Plus, the most important elements are the general concepts of limited government. Now, this is a little piece of a show I did a couple weeks ago, expanded to a whole show because there was so much to talk about. I thought we should do that, especially in this particular time element in history when it appears, at least in the United States, these concepts are to the forefront of our thought process and in our daily, we'll say, news programs and, we'll say, also editorials and people's opinions. There's a lot to be said here, and maybe there's a lot to be learned. Hopefully there is. So what do I mean by spiritual principles in ageless wisdom? Well, as you know, I've been teaching ageless wisdom for decades. And here on radio for like 9 years or so. The issue about principles is that it's something that has shown itself to be, this is the definition now, something that has shown itself to be accurate when applied to many different examples and circumstances and is proven to be at a level of accuracy that in most circumstances can be depended upon to be something that is universal and has, we'll say, only slight, if any, exceptions. So that's what I mean by a principle. A principle is not perfect. Why not? Because no matter what the circumstance, the universe is based upon creativity. So even though a principle applies and has applied in, we'll say, historical context, since it's living beings like ourselves and beyond us who are creating in the universe and God itself is in a state of creation, then we would say that the principles of ageless wisdom can be altered to some extent by the level of capability of creation. However, the longer the principles have applied and the more often they have been, so to speak, proven to be accurate, the more difficult it is to create something that is spiritual and changes that principle. Spiritual means that it represents God's mind by becoming enlightening and improving the senses and consciousness of all others who experience it. Something's not spiritual if it does the reverse, lowers consciousness and decreases the awareness or senses of sentient beings like ourselves. Okay, so that's what we mean by spiritual principles. And, of course, ageless wisdom is just, generally speaking, the means of expressing how God is a creator and functions within the universe. And it shows or explains, in many respects, or by revealing, the God that I'm referring to. So ageless wisdom is a wise way of revelation of God. What does wise revelation mean? Well, it means that it helps people to gain further understanding of God by gaining an understanding of ageless wisdom. So if it does that, then it is wisdom, and it's ageless because it continually changes, remember, by the first definition I gave about principles. And it isn't ancient wisdom, which some people like that word or name, but unfortunately ancient wisdom would mean that it's unchangeable, and therefore it disallows the possibility, even likelihood, of some creative element changing some of the principles and even some of the elements of the wisdom of those principles. Wise principles do exactly what I said. They expand by the fact that they are spiritual, the base of understanding. They expand, or consciousness, and they expand the level of awareness or sensing. Right. And that is just by having experience with and interaction with these principles in ancient wisdom. It isn't by some magic. It means that each person is going to apply their own thought processes and their own interactions to determine for themselves these quote-unquote principles. Now, some people will say, well, what about truth? Well, truth changes, unfortunately, more often than principles do. Principles apply, if they're spiritual, for much longer periods of time than truth does. Truth is what can be proven at the moment, based not only on everything else I said about principles, but also truth involves our level of knowledge. And as knowledge levels change, unfortunately, truth can also change. So truth is a good thing, and as a basic, we'll call it virtue, that human beings attempt to create, it's the truth of the mental world. It's the virtue of the mental world. It's a very good thing, but it's a limited virtue, because it's one of the three virtues, we'll say, that are more humanly inspired, more humanly created. And human beings are vastly limited in their ability to gain knowledge because we aren't omniscient or all-knowing. Beings who live beyond the mental world, who are all-knowing or omniscient about whatever it is that they may be, quote-unquote, creating some level of truth about, are then involved in creating beyond truth or principles. They then are the true creators of any change that might happen in principles. Rarely is a principle even affected by a human being. Some truth is, though, obviously. That's because we don't have all knowledge. We're far from that. Unfortunately, being omniscient is not yet a human ability, and it may never be. We may never reach the point where human beings become omniscient, because once they do, they're not human anymore. And for right now, that's my understanding of it. Are there worlds where that may be different? Possibly. Because we know that the standards change and vary from planet to planet based upon all kinds of very difficult things to understand for most of us. But for right now, I think that's the best I can do in defining these things. Now you're probably going, whoa, that was way too fast to define all that stuff. Well, guess what? You can push the replay button if you want to. Not tonight you can't, but in a few days when this show goes up. You can go ahead and re-listen to that and say, oh, so that's what he was saying. I went by too fast. I didn't really catch it all. I know. On these relatively long and difficult definitions, I don't spend a huge amount of time. And the reason for it is this, that they are difficult. And no matter how much time I may spend, the few people who get it, and the people who don't can re-listen. And so it isn't like it's impossible for people to understand it. It's just that they may have to do an awful lot of thinking, and there's no time while I'm talking for you all to be thinking about what I said 5 minutes ago. Otherwise, you'll miss the rest of the show, right? And so it kind of works against the medium that we're in. If we were interactive and I was talking back and forth with people on a regular basis, not just someone calling in once in a blue moon, but then it would be a kind of different situation, and it might lend itself to that kind of interaction better. But as it is right now, I think we're doing the best we can. I've tried to balance this whole thing out. And I'm not saying it's perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's It's okay. Now, limiting government, what does that mean? Why do we want to limit government? Government is a construct, in human terms, of the first type of energy and first type of, we'll call it, first type of way of interaction. Energy causes interaction. It's the first way that people can interact. Why is that so important? What does the first kind of interaction, which is also called sometimes a ray, it's just a ray is just energy following thought. So basically, it's the first way of thinking that changes energy. And what's so important that it becomes government? And that's because it is the way that we construct the foundation of our social existence. You can come up with a lot of alternatives that might sound like they could be important ways of doing things as a foundation. But government actually pervades and is more both improving and creative, and it's also destructive and disallowing people to freely interrelate. So its purpose is, ultimately, to safeguard the right for people to freely interrelate and communicate and all the things in relation is about it. But it unfortunately has a dual side to it. The first ray itself, the first type of energy, has a dual side. The first is to create, and the second is to destroy. When anything that is founded around or in the first type of energy is not creating more interaction that is spiritual, more interaction that is helpful to each side to grow more in their awareness and consciousness of God, it then becomes destructive. And the problem with government is that people give up their right as an individual to some extent to be free in their interactions, so that the collective right along the second way, or group consciousness, can be eventually developed and employed in the society that they live in. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It's supposed to happen that way. When the two get balanced, the second part of energy with the first, you end up with spirit, you end up with God, you end up with light, an enlightened society. Very good stuff. The problem is that it's the balance that usually is the problem, and it gets into this thing. And the limiting of government is necessary, because if government is not limited, it takes the individual freedoms that people give up, and it starts demanding on its own more and more of those freedoms for its own power and control, oftentimes related to individuals, people in the government, who use or abuse the government for that purpose. Once that starts to take place, the whole society becomes more and more dark. And eventually it leads to a condition called tyranny. What's tyranny? Tyranny is the end of the government becoming more and more dark through individuals within it, removing the freedoms of the basic rights of citizens. And tyranny could be described as a successful destruction of, we'll say, the majority of people's freedoms that are basic to their existence. Then you have tyranny. Something less than the majority, maybe a minority, would be considered a government that is dark and not good, but it may not be tyranny. Tyranny is sort of like the really dark, dark side. And once you get to that point, there's little return. The government itself has to, in one way or another, be destroyed in order to achieve reestablishing freedom. Or everybody leaves. I guess that's another option if you have such a thing, but that's rare. And in today's world, difficult, if not impossible, to do. All right, so we get back to now the question, how much do you need to limit government in the definitions based upon spiritual principles and angels' wisdom so that you do not reach even near the state of tyranny and you have this almost perfect balance where the amount of freedoms everybody gives up is returned to them in group consciousness and love and understanding among all peoples, with no one really losing anything as long as the group conscious side of the society is in balance with the freedom side. So what do you do to limit government? Well, you make rules, sometimes referred to as constitutional or basic levels of what government can and can't do to enforce or force the government to keep a balance. And when it doesn't, you severely punish the individuals in the government who are responsible for making sure of this to the point where they can no longer have the right to govern in various ways, which could include things like treason and death and imprisonment and all kinds of terrible things. I mean, from being treasonable. And it is not meant to be punitive on all people who necessarily make the error of trying to be over-controlling, but it is meant to get them out of the government. And that's the key. You must quickly and efficiently remove people from government who have the inkling, if not the propensity, and are doing so, of acting to reduce the freedom of others for their own sake of wanting to control, even though they claim it's based upon some principle of socialism or this ism or that ism, or maybe because they think spare the rod, spoil the child, whatever they come up with as an answer. It doesn't matter. Once it's in violation of the basic constitutional elements of what the government was founded upon, then there needs to be swift and virtually automatic restriction in the terms of what I mean by limiting government. Now, you can say, well, why can't government be limited by a constitution that everybody just has some kind of agreement? Then you have the Supreme Court, like in the United States, which after 5, 10, 15, 20 years or more, eventually hears a case about it and then comes to some conclusion. Why can't that be good enough? After all, the forefathers supposedly came up with that kind of system. Well, they did and they didn't. What they did is they said the government had certain abilities or powers. And then what happened was that instead of being an original processing mechanism, the Supreme Court, and then unfortunately the legislature, and then unfortunately the presidents and everybody else, eventually took it upon themselves to say that the Constitution was not a document that was a limiting government, limiting instrument. It was a living instrument which could be changed based upon the circumstances at hand at any particular time. Well, who's going to change it? Well, the people who want to change because they want to gain more power and control and take the freedoms away from everybody else. That's the problem. And there has not been an adequate solution, at least in the United States and a few other countries I could name, that also have pretty good constitutions but pretty bad governments. So it's an issue about application and having more based upon the fact that we've grown a lot in our mental structure as a people here on Earth. I'm not just talking about a specific country now, to the point where we have to and need to have more specific language in a restriction on government so that others can't hide behind and maneuver around the old general statements that government is limited from this area, from that area, etc., without dealing with the nuts and bolts. Constitutions are great, but they have to, on occasion, be brought up to speed not on making them more expansive and liberal from the standpoint of removing the freedoms of people, but they need to be tightened up by restricting the government more. The restrictions on the government come from, we'll say, consequences of breaking the constitutional bases that are principles that are in the Constitution. And my suggestion is today that those principles be based, at least in part, if not totally, in ageless wisdom and on spiritual principles rather than mundane ones. Now, that does not mean I'm suggesting that the Constitution forces anybody to believe that those spiritual principles upon which the Constitution is based, only that their own freedoms are being protected, regardless of where or how they think those principles came from. So it is not. This is not a. We're not talking about a religious or theocracy of sorts. Just the opposite, as you'll see in the rest of the show. But nonetheless, this is. Where one of the problems lies is that people don't know the difference between spiritual principles and religion and, we'll say, belief in God or reliance upon God. There's a whole range of issues that have gotten confused. Tonight's show, we're going to try to deal with those and make sure that they are clearly defined and understood to the point where we can take tonight's show and maybe with 100 people sit down and write a new constitution for a country. It doesn't have to be the United States, but for a country that would achieve much greater freedom for all the libertarians out there, much greater balance between the first and second waves for the, believe it or not, conservatives out there, and much more liberal aspects, strangely, in all of that, that allows people to have a semi-utopian sense of group cooperation, of group consciousness, that's leading to a soul level of consciousness, which is what ultimately people who are utopian liberals want. Now, what about liberals that aren't utopian liberals, like communistic liberals? Well, they rely upon force and power and control as the means of developing that form of, we'll say, government. And that is not what I'm talking about tonight, because that's an unlimited government or near unlimited government. I'm talking about limiting government. So communistic governments are by nature unlimited or nearly unlimited, and therefore are very dark and evil. So are most, but not all, socialistic governments, and so are most, if not all, fascistic types of socialistic governments, which just means that the power is applied to the socialist system through the government, whereas in communism, power is applied from the government onto the individual, which is much more severe, because if you control businesses or you control institutions within the government, people suffer, but they suffer collectively as a group mostly. Whereas if you apply communistic principles based upon Marx and Engels or dozens of other people, including, believe it or not, good old Mao, who was really a terror, and same with Joseph Stalin and others in the communist camp, those folks, and Lenin, of course, you end up with them, the government, directly interfering in the individual's life, directly, including sending them out to gulags, forcing rethinking methods, as was done early on in the Maoist regime in the 1950s, and then eventually just killing people or starving them to death through less, we'll say, direct means, but they still die, and using extremely brutal methods. Or like Joseph Stalin, having hit lists of all the folks you don't like, which amounts into the millions, some of the more brighter intellectual people, and just killing them because they may not, they may collectively get together and do something bad to you, so you'll fix them first. You know, okay. That's all part of the forceful nature of communism. And again, it's unlimited government, and we won't be dealing with that tonight because we assume if we're discussing how to limit government, those kinds of systems are incompatible. They cannot be employed. Okay, what about pure democracy versus republic? I'm running right where I expected to be. All right, so pure democracy is where you've heard the old story, one man, one vote, or one woman, one vote. But the thing is that it's really about employing strictly a majority system to the government itself. The problem there is that you do not end up with limited government. Now, that's going to surprise some of you. Let me explain. If the majority of people are making decisions about the freedoms of all people, almost invariably the minority freedoms will be gradually eroded and destroyed. Not because the majority of people have some terrible, they're out for or don't want to do something terrible to the minorities. No. What they do is they just vote based upon certain desires along with principles, along with thoughts and other issues. And when they do so, gradually over time, the rights of the minorities are destroyed. It's a consequence. It's not something that they contrive and say, well, we're going to do this to them. How do you correct that? Well, the founding fathers in the United States came up with a really good system. They said, why don't we do this? First of all, let's collectivize smaller portions of the United States into states. Of course, they already existed, so they didn't have to worry too much about that, but it kind of helped them out. And then let's take those states and allow each state to have its own votes and its own structure, which would limit then the power of the national government. In addition, let's do something else. Let's make it so that part of the government is controlled by not the votes of the majority, but controlled on issue to issue based upon the wisdom of those that are most found to be most wise and who are voted into office for a limited period of time and who have limited powers on an individual level themselves. That's where you get into Congress and certain other positions that are decided upon. And then you could say, well, what about the people on the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court? They're voted in for life. Well, it's kind of a balance to the whole thing. It's sort of like saying, we'll give 9 people the ultimate right to decide when the rest of the government isn't working very well and to see if a mistake has been made. But they don't have a right to intervene until it's brought to their attention by going up a whole complicated legal system. And so it takes a very long time. And necessarily so you don't have an oligarchy of justices, Supreme Court justices, who run the country. So this is all balance. It's the thing we call checks and balances here in the U.S. It really is the idea. All right, so you have a republic where you divide up segments of the society, which gives the minorities many more rights because they, as a voting bloc, may have the exact or even more rights than some of the quote-unquote more majority-minded citizens on certain subject areas. This allows for more freedom, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to limit government and produce more freedom. Pure democracies can lead, believe it or not, to eventually tyranny. Keener. They don't all do that by any stretch. But almost all tyrannical governments have used democracy in an evil way to get to the point where they have developed tyranny. Isn't that scary? Whoa. Okay, so most of the really tyrannical governments call themselves democracies. Some of them, because they caught on, call themselves a republic as well, which is almost always a lie. All right, so this is a very interesting kind of concept, and I hope that some of this makes sense to you. Now, a lot of you may say, well, I heard some of these things before, but never quite like all together at once. Well, that's okay. I'm just trying to sum this thing up. I'm not trying to say that everything I'm saying hasn't been said before. It may have, and I hope it has. But the point is that it's not working very good just because somebody said it. Like I said, the founding fathers came up with a lot of good ideas, but their applications have been stunted by, unfortunately, the, we'll call it, will of those in government who want to have control and power, more than anybody else, it's true. Now, you could say, well, what happened when the women's movement and all that business. Isn't it good that women eventually got the right to vote and we got rid of slavery, too, and that's another good thing that happened? But, if you look at our history here in the United States, we can say, and I think with some authority about this, that ultimately it's a mixed bag. Women got the right to vote. And once they got the right to vote, within another, and this is so strange, 7 years or so, they changed the laws. Now think about this. They changed the laws by a vote on an amendment, the 18th Amendment, to prevent their husbands and brothers and, for the most part, men, from drinking to excess and destroying the family unit. And they thought it would be good if government got involved in that because families are being destroyed by alcoholism and by husbands and sons and et cetera, acting so irresponsibly. Now you could say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, we learned an important lesson in that respect here in the United States. And that lesson is that trying to abridge the rights of people who are abusing substances or, we'll say, the system in general, for their own needs, desires, and, let's say, emotional feelings about things, inevitably leads to corruption, destruction of more than what it cures or settles, and a billowing out of governmental power into areas where it should not have been in the first place and then should never be in the future after those acts are made. Now, I know it was repealed, but you know what? The damage was done, and although we repealed the right for people to consume alcohol, or own it, the problem is much worse because many other laws were adopted and enacted, including the a means of income tax that became very obtrusive and destructive because it allowed the government to grow almost endlessly. But it did all that at a huge cost that remained as part of the society, even though the amendment itself was repealed. So if we're going to limit government, we have to be very careful because once we open the floodgates on giving government more power, that power can be manifested in so many different ways that once we can take away the original offending issue and still have a government that's just as bad or worse than it ever was. And that's very hard to change. You almost have to have at least an intellectual revolution, if not a real physical one. And that's a bad thing, because that means that government is so resistant to change that once it is going very much towards totalitarianism and tyranny, the process almost always ends up in a violent fashion. And we don't want that, of course. The object is to avoid violence. So, what's the nature? What was the problem in trying to change the social behaviors of people through government? Well, the correct means would have been to balance it with education, much less of the first type of energy and much more of the second. If people had been educated and taught about the effects of alcohol on a more wider scale, especially boys, since they seem to be becoming alcoholics much more often than girls, we're talking about a 10-to-1 ratio here, then the point would be that you need then to have the balance. Remember, the balance is spiritual. Lack of balance means darkness. We got darkness, right? So less government authority. Let me give you an example so that we can be clear about this. We make it that people can only consume or buy so much alcohol per week. That's still a very limiting thing, but you can only buy so much alcohol per week. It doesn't solve the problem, and there's lots of ways around it. But at the same time, and it's only for 10 years that you do that, and then at the same time, for during that 10 years, there is a tremendous effort to educate people about how alcohol is destructive to their personal self, how it increases diseases and aging and all kinds of terrible things, and how the most important thing, it destroys families, etc., and what people can do to replace alcohol as a means of escape in dealing with life pressures and problems that they have fears about. And that requires more spiritual development so that they're not in their personality subconsciously being afraid of their life, but they find more ways to be creative in their life. So a spiritual approach, again, comes through education, and after 10 years, the whole thing has to be undone. So you make absolutely sure, even that limitation, which doesn't seem nearly as bad as the complete restriction of all alcohol, will only last long enough so people have some, we'll say, period of time, 10 years, to teach the young, which will be up to about age 15 or 16 in young people, about, which is almost the next generation, about not having to rely on pot alcohol so much or at all, and find alternative methods. And maybe we get rid of a third or half of all the alcoholics, and we reduce by maybe 75% the amount of problems in social family networks and things. Because although you get rid of only half the alcoholics, the other half aren't even married. They're so bad off, so you don't worry that much about them. It's the ones that are not quite at that level that you're more worried about. They are going to be more destructive to the family structure. So you can really resolve a large part of that problem if we could go back to 1920. We could go back there. And that's about when the law was actually enacted. I think it was passed in 19 and became effective sometime in 20 or it was 20 and 21. I can't remember for sure. But the point is that if we could go back to that time, instead change this whole thing to this 10-year and the education and the whole deal. And the education does not have to come from the federal government, by the way. This could have been done much better on a statewide issue from state to state in a lot of other ways. The federal government could have only chosen the limitation on how much for the 10 years, et cetera. And why 10 years? Because it would take more than that for criminals to find it really beneficial to go into bootlegging and to use alcohol as a stepping stone to many other criminal businesses. And so it took about that long to really get to that point. And they wouldn't find it as beneficial because they would know that there's a certain date where this is just all going away anyway. That's why you don't want to enact any kind of law that is permanent if you can get away with making it transient. Aha, another principle. Make things that are restrictive, limited in time, so that they cannot be brought back. And also even make it so that you can't just say, I want to extend the time at the end of 10 years. No, you can't do it for at least 10 years more or 20 or whatever. You make it so that freedom comes first, but you also make it to try to balance as best as possible with education. There's no proof, no guarantee. The education will work, or to give it some chance. And maybe each year, after 5 years, you start lessening the restriction too. So that people start learning how to be free without being self-destructive and other destructive. When we look at this, this is really not a bad plan. But anyway, for right now, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, I'll tell you so much more. And we will be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we are talking about limiting government based upon spiritual principles in ageless wisdom. And you might say, whoa, that sounds like a big title. Well, it kind of is, and I hope that if you heard the first part of this show, you are realizing now that this really is bigger than it may sound. But I hope also by the end of tonight, we will have, well, at least I have, will have expressed enough various, we'll say, topics that it could be used almost like a blueprint if you wanted to try to make a better society by limiting government. That's the whole purpose. So if I can get there, then I'd say then we've made some progress, and that's tremendously beneficial. Okay, let's talk about some of the more fundamental issues. You notice in the last segment, I brought up taxes, particularly income taxes. And what is wrong with government having some pipeline to support itself? Like, we'll have a progressive tax system based upon people who call themselves progressives. What is progressive? A lot of people think progressive has to do with the future, like, oh, we're moving ahead in the future. That was not its original meaning, for those of you who don't know. Its original meaning was to move society in a way in which the people in the bottom parts of the society are able to be brought up and become leveled with the people in the top parts of society. You didn't know that, huh? Well, that's what progressive actually was meant. It comes from a utopian idea of equality of all peoples, but it is based upon false or misleading ideas that are not spiritual principles in ageless wisdom, but would be considered to be anti-spiritual or not in accord with God's mind or thought. Now, why is that? And for those, some of you who are progressives, you may be pretty upset me saying this, but let me explain what's wrong with it, and then we'll see how it generally doesn't apply very well to limiting government. Now, the process is this. If you decide that you want people to be approximately equal in their interactions and activities, then you have reversed God's thought. God's thought is to try to get people to be to grow as much as they choose to in their thinking, which includes understanding, along with creativity and freedom of thought. Those two have to come together. So they have this unlimited ability to increase this and be open to being able to enjoy that. That's God's thought. And then in terms of interactions, the interaction is the freedom to choose to progress in terms of development of interactions, in terms of creating more light in the world or not, or to not do so. In other words, you're free to not be creative, not to have more interactions. If you want limited interactions, that's the way you can make your life. And you can go down that road as far as you want to go. You may find it gets pretty boring, and before long you don't have enough food to eat, and you may have other issues, no clothes to wear, things like that. But it is your right to do that in God's mind. But in a progressive's mind, it's not your right to do that. It's the government's right to enact or enforce that everybody have the same or similar amounts of clothes, food, and other factors, health care, even though it may be health care that they don't want or health care that isn't right for them, but they're going to have it anyway. This is the foundation of progressivism, and it was adopted by various utopian groups in the 1820s, 1830s, in a number of countries, including the United States. These groups came to fruition and developed to maximum levels about 1860 to 1880, with the Civil War in the United States kind of putting the kibosh on their development for a while. A lot of the groups in the 1840s and 1850s actually started to burn out before the Civil War, and then some of the groups that were most successful in attempting the exercise in utopian progressivism did so after the Civil War, sometimes 1870, 1880, even up to the 1890s. Now, you could say, okay, well, whatever happened to those folks? Well, what happened to all these utopian communities that went off and tried this progressive thing? How did it all work out? Well, not too good for them, but maybe good for the rest of us. They discovered something that was the following, that it was not human nature for human beings to give up their individuality as to become some kind of group of total equality. Because when they did that, instead of seeking a fairness issue where everybody has the same, et cetera, they became stifled in their creativity and lacked the ability to exercise their individual thought in their interactions. That caused many people to rebel against the utopian societies they so fervently tried to create, and for these societies to kind of quickly fall apart within, we'll say, years to a decade or so. And so these experiments were done, not just here in the United States, but throughout some parts of Europe, some parts of other countries as well. Even in the very beginnings of Australia as a country, there were several groups that tried this to usually find out what I just said. And then it was also tried in strange places. Africa. Weird as that sounds. There were some original founded colonies in Africa that got freed, like in Liberia, where the Africans were freed. And that was under Monroe, our president, who tried to make sure that was done. And they tried to set up a utopian country based upon progressive thought, using, strangely, the U.S. Constitution as their foundation, but applying progressivism to the society itself. Everybody's going to be equal, everybody has the same amount of things, everybody. And it fell apart quickly, became anarchical, civil war to some extent, and eventually severe corruption, with warlords and corrupt people running things and tyranny all over the place, and just unbelievable. And yet these people were mostly black people who were free. They were free. They were not slaves. And they were given some monies to actually set the society up because of the desire to have a place where the idea for the people of the United States to start this, they were abolitionists, but back in the 1830s, they wanted to have some place where maybe if they could just free all the slaves here, they could go back to Africa and have some life for themselves. Didn't work out too good, though, because progressivism eroded the very foundation of what they were attempting to do. And so the utopian country of Liberia became a just unbelievable shambles with virtually no freedom for anybody because the unruly criminals and evil people were running it. It went so dark it was terrible. Well, why didn't we learn from that? How could it be? We go through all these experiments. It's all throughout the world. And it keeps failing. Progressivism is crazy, you know. And then the progressivism in the early 1870s starts becoming a thing called socialism, and that too is suddenly touted as the next great thing for everybody. And there's a colonel that says, "Oh, this is the way to be," and he's a real military kind of guy. So he was the first fascist, actually. He was the first fascistic socialist. And it started in London, of all places. Not in Germany. And the Germans are actually having fun being great with capitalism. But you had these folks, and they said, no, we're going to do it our way. How could all of this happen, and where did we go wrong, and how is it that after 1890, they just didn't throw this crazy idea out? Well, I already explained that in the first part, is that women really bought into, because it's a second part of God's mind, it's more feminine, they really bought into this. They said, yes, we could all still make it work if it just wasn't for the men going off and drinking and, you know, getting us pregnant all the time and forcing us to do their bidding and being superior by restricting our inability to vote restricting our ability to vote. And this was a big issue. Now, I don't want you to think I'm blaming progressivism just on women, but they revived the movement from one generation to the next. If you don't study history, you are going to repeat it, and that's exactly what happened. The women, because they so strongly were fighting to get the vote, which they certainly deserved and should have gotten long before, in the fight for their freedom to vote, they brought in all the progressives into their own movement because the progressives said, yeah, we all should be equal. And they thought that was the same as them getting the vote, right? Because they'd be equal with men then. But what they didn't realize was they were selling their soul to the devil. They got a much bigger wrong concept that had failed over and over again for a century. Because our minds were growing as human beings. We were becoming more logical. We're becoming more thoughtful. But we have all these isms that suddenly popped up. Communism, Marx and Engels in 1860. I mean, all this stuff is coming into our thought process, and some people say latch onto it and say, well, that sounds good. Yeah, we'll all be equal. Oh, we'll have to kill a few people. It doesn't matter. So the progressives weren't, don't get me wrong, they weren't necessarily trying to kill people. But they used all of the stuff that women had as issues. Margaret Sanger was a seriously strong, we'll call it, progressive. And she came up with women should have a right to birth control. Well, at first the women loved it. They said that's terrific. But what they don't know about Margaret was she was also very severely, in my opinion, biased against black people. And she saw it as a way of population control for the blacks because she was worried that too many black people would grow in population versus white. She actually was against that. Now, it's a really atrocious thing, and you know she's considered a hero among women, you know, women's rights groups. But if you really look deeply into, or not even that deeply into her biographies, it's scary. Okay, so she had a blemish to say the least, but it's worse than that because in convincing women that the way they can gain control over their family and their lives, because the women are concerned mostly about their children, was to prevent men from constantly keeping them pregnant. And that meant birth control. But birth control meant that you had to stop the government from restricting it or preventing it. Obviously, the correct thing was to get the government to stop restricting birth control, but at the same time, not making the government responsible for the reproductive factors of people, period. Government shouldn't have anything to do with that stuff. Good or bad, it should have nothing to do with it, period. You say, well, what about the federal system? Why could some states have it and some not? Well, yeah, it's okay, but if it gets down to the level of whether or not you can use birth control, that is not appropriate. I don't care if you're a Catholic and you believe otherwise. It makes no difference. That's why religion has to stay out of government. And at that time, there was a strong Catholic constituency that believed that birth control was infanticide because you're killing the seed that eventually becomes the infant with the fetus in between. So ultimately, they say, well, it leads to that, so therefore, if you stop it, then you're preventing the birth of children. And, of course, that was the furthest thing from the truth. The truth was, if you have too many children, you can't support them properly. You can't teach them. And then the men become despondent, and they don't know how to make enough money to support these large families. And the next thing you know, they go out drinking. You see, there's an interconnectivity between one evil leading to another. Now, I hope that I'm not confusing anybody and going so fast on the subject, but I want to cover a lot of ground tonight. And there's a lot of stuff to talk about here. And it has to do with right now, believe me. If you don't think progressivism is a modern subject, wait, if I have a chance to finish the show. All right, so here we got all kinds of goofy things going on that have unintended consequences of severe magnitude. We are constantly looking to government to solve problems when government is the problem. Limiting government is the key to solving most of the problems of government, whereas the problems of society should not be mostly solved by government. They should be solved by us, the people. There's many better ways to deal with the issue of birth control if you don't like birth control. The first is to not practice it yourself. The second is to promote it in ways that are based upon argument and thought, and to see within the realm of arguments today, which we have the internet, it's so wonderful, see if others go along with it. If they don't, guess what? Too bad. You don't have a right to control others. You have a right to express your opinion, which may have an effect on others. I mean, all right, so this idea that government was going to be the solution developed from the progressive movement, and even though the movement itself kind of bit the dust, mostly because it led to the Great Depression, and aggravated the Great Depression because government got so much bigger and promoted even more progressivism. So it prolonged it until World War II. And World War II led to an increase in freedom and individualism because you needed that. It's weird. A war usually restricts freedoms, right? The government gets bigger. It has to control everything. But in the weirdest of ways, that only happened in terms of, we'll call treasonable acts and things like that. For most people, they actually got more freedom. How do I say that? Why do I say that? Well, quickly, I'll tell you. Women got all the rights that they were really looking for when they changed the right to vote. They actually got into the workplace. They actually changed their activity levels to be more on par with men, especially when they're all fighting the war, right? Okay, that's number one. Number two, what else happened? Well, we had much less wealth that we could use for, we'll say, the things that are optional in life, because we were using so much of our resources to unfortunately fight darkness on the other side of the world. It somewhat came here, too, a little bit, but mostly on the other side of the world. So we were doing all that. When we did that, we gained an appreciation for the things that are non-material. It actually had an effect on consciousness for a number of years. But then there was basically a backlash. It took place from 1947 or so, 46, 47, and suddenly materialism started to grow through the 50s very badly. That's what happened. But at least for a time, that was a big deal. What also happened? Well, religion became freer because so many people were in the military with different religions. And racism became more tolerable. It even got into sports eventually in the late 40s. And it allowed people to become more, we'll say, accepted in society. Yes, there was a backlash back again in the wonderful 50s. But the point is, it allowed these things to take place. So the war did have some benefits that most people don't see that. The World War did. Okay, back to the progressives and the issues here. So ultimately, we've got to look at the situation that you have to limit the government to really increase freedom, and the limitations need to be generalized and not specific, and they can't support a specific viewpoint of a religion or of anybody. Non-religious people, religious people, whatever the viewpoint is, it can't be specific. It is about increasing spiritual activity using spiritual principles, and it's about allowing people to be more free than they ever have been, balanced with more loving and group conscious and we'll say soul-like in their nature, allowing them to also develop humility. All of these things are what limited government can provide. All right. Let me stop for a second here. I'm going to take a breath, and we'll come back to this most interesting and fascinating subject, which I think is really great. The last few weeks I've been talking about the Eye Center. I want you to know that Dr. David Stacy, he's a OD, is, in my mind, a great doctor. You know what happened last time I was in here? I don't think any of you did actually drop by during my office visit. I mentioned when I was going, though. I know some of you came, and thank you for doing it. I think that you're going to get good benefits from going there. Anyway, we were talking, he and I, and I have some ideas, some theories about how you could improve the eye exam, the process. getting contact lenses and glasses, etc. So one of the things we did is we actually went outside, and I was looking at things differently than I would in his office. We tried some other stuff, and I suggested some of these things. And he's actually going to experiment with them, which is good, because it means he's an open-minded fellow who is willing to try new things to help his patients see better. That's what I'm trying to do. And seeing better, in my case, by the way, isn't a tremendous, isn't like I'm walking around blind, but it does, I'm 64, and once you get over 60, your vision generally gets less stable because you have oxidation of the lens, and the lens starts to get brittle and doesn't move as easily. Your muscles may get a little tired trying to move it as well. You got a thing called presbyopia, which is like you can't see things really close to your eye. You have to wear reading glasses. And I don't want to use reading glasses unless I have to. But the point is that those kinds of things happen because things wear out, and also it's due to, strangely, pollution. Believe it or not, pollution has some significant effects on it, just like it changes rubber into hard things and makes the tires on your cars fail long before the tread wears out, because the sidewalls break down and the tire develops breaks in it due to oxidation, oftentimes from ozone in the air and a lot of other chemistry things that are going on. Well, believe it or not, the lens of your eye kind of does the same thing. It's kind of brittle, doesn't move very easily, and it can develop little cracks in it that eventually the cracks get darker and fuzzier, and it gets cataracts, and other bad things can happen. So, in the meantime, if that's slightly occurring, it may not even be traceable to any of these events in the beginning, you can wear certain kinds of contact lenses and other things that not only improves your vision, but they actually might absorb some of those toxins themselves, especially if they're discardable every few weeks. And that is a good thing, because your eyes don't take the brunt of the garbage in the air. The contacts are kind of doing that. Glasses don't do that for you. Glasses can correct the vision, but they won't protect the cornea and the lens as much. So it's one of those issues that's hard to convince people of, but I think there's some truth to it. But it's, you still want a lens that is gas permeable. It's just that some of the gas that goes through it, you want the lens to absorb and become, over time, a little brittle, a little foggy, and that's exactly what they do. That's why you have to get rid of them. Interesting, huh? Interesting stuff. And then they also can get contaminated with germs, which is another bad thing. So anyway, so these are theories that we've been talking about, and we're coming up with some interesting ideas and thoughts. And if you really are looking for an eye doctor, and you haven't found someone who wants to work with you to get to the point where you want to be in terms of your vision, you should try the Eye Center. It's over at 2974 North Alma School Road, Suite 3 in Chandler. And that's on the southwest corner of Alma School and Elliott. Southwest corner of Alma School and Elliott. So if you're anywhere in the Phoenix area, you can check into it. The Eye Center, theeyecenter.org, you can go to that on your internet. It is Dr. David Stacy. Okay? And let me give you their phone number in case you want that. I'm sure you might. 480-899-0188. 480-899-0188. All right, let's come back to our topic for this evening. Limiting government based upon spiritual principles in ageless wisdom. That's what it's about. What can we do if we're going to try to make a government more limiting on a global scale? That's what we're talking about. This gets into what I mentioned for about 5 or 10 minutes. Unfortunately, I didn't have a lot of time on one of the earlier shows in the last month. And that is that the Constitution needs to be, we'll say, fine-tuned a little bit. Not a lot of changes, and not changes that limits us, but limits the government more. Where can we do that? What kinds of things would be good? Well, the first thing is probably the corruption issue in government is pretty high. We have right now a very progressive form of government. government. It's not just Obama. Obama is much worse than a progressive. He's a communist. But that's a whole other issue. It's that the president before Obama, you know, George W. Bush, he was a progressive. The guy that ran against Obama, yeah, McCain, he was a progressive. So we have progressives, both parties, basically trying to color their form of progressivism and hide it sometimes with their, we'll call it their, the platform or the general principles of their party. But unfortunately, progressivism has some really serious flaws and is not compatible with spiritual principles in Angel's Wisdom. That's tough for me to say, because this also applies to to Mitt Romney, and probably George's father as well. Why does it apply to Mitt Romney? Well, because in about 60-70% of the things he says, he is non-progressive. But in 30-40% of the things he says, he's progressive. Where is he progressive? He believes in progressive taxation, but that's the big problem. And progressive taxation, which is where we left off before the break, or before this, before the time I talked about Dr. Stacey, progressive taxation gives the government a continuous infusion of more and more money. You never want to do that, because the more money the government has, the more power it has to take more freedoms away from us. So how do you check this thing anyway? Where are the checks and balances that applies? Well, the best check and balance is to make people equally responsible for the losses of their own freedoms through the taxation system. Now, I know that that sounds cruel to some folks out there, and I want to be honest with you. Life is not fair and balanced. Life in itself is unequal based upon an individual's right to choose how to live and what to create in their life. They can say, well, what about the people born with birth defects or this or that and everything else? Those people, we could supply charity to, we could have what is called a safety debt to, but you can't solve the problem by not taxing them, or by taxing them to such ridiculously low levels that they don't care about the risky and serious problems that a growing government entails. They're willing to sell that off to live without having to put out much effort. They're getting something for nothing, and that's where that show was that I talked about this subject before. You've got to be extremely careful to prevent that. And you can't do it in a progressive taxation system, because the fundamental nature is that it allows so many people to become so irresponsible about not only their own freedom, but the freedom and rights of so many other people. They're willing to sell it out so they don't have to pay their fair share or whatever of taxes, their share of taxes. So what really is the fundamental way of dealing with this? Well, I know that this is not going to be popular among progressives, but the fundamental way is to have a flat tax, a tax that is equally applied to all people, but that is so low that it doesn't take the ability for the poor among us to be able to afford food, provided they have a job of some sort. If they don't have a job, then we should have training. We should have many other ways to help these folks. And if they can't be trained because they have severe disabilities, we should find ways that they can enable themselves to get around their disability, but still not allow them to starve to death and not prevent them from staying reasonably healthy. This is a more fundamental approach. When you try to solve it by making people, quote-unquote, more equal in what they have, not equal in what they contribute, well, people that are equal in what they have are not equal at all, because you have creators who may stop creating or may become frustrated by the system, and then you have the non-creators who become much worse than non-creating because they're being given to unwisely. Unwise giving cannot be spiritual. Spirituality is based upon, at a minimum, wisdom, as I talked about at the beginning of the show. So there's no way around it. Now, it's not that I really want to condemn anybody about this. I don't. I wish that Mitt Romney didn't have this as his part of his posture, part of his story. But I'm going to tell you right now, even though he does, he's a far cry from Obama. What's wrong with Obama? Well, Obama's gone far afield of progressivism. He only talks a progressive line to convince the progressives to back him. But he's not a progressive. He really isn't. The guy has, we'll say, serious control problems, serious issues with narcissism, serious problems of character. He lies all the time. And you don't have to take my word for it. Just listen to what he said last week, last month, etc. Get a book about The Great Destroyer by David Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh's brother, who's an attorney, and he does a pretty decent job in that book of explaining a lot of stuff. The Great Destroyer. Read it. It's available everywhere. It's like a bestseller, so you should be able to read it. And it's only been out a few months, and I think it's doing a good job in what it's supposed to do. But here's the bottom line. If you have to compare somebody who's a colonial-style communist like his father was, mixed in with a bunch of Walensky and other people, and that means he's a rebel. That means he's out there, if he has to lie, cheat, or steal, or do whatever he needs to do to win so that he controls other people under, this is the thought in communism, he does it. And he does it with no sense of, let's say, remorse, no conscience. Sound serious? I think so. Romney has a conscience. Part of his conscience is telling him the wrong things. Maybe he'll listen to tonight's show. Maybe he'll rethink some of his positions. You know, progressivism is not completely destructive to a person's ability to be a good president. It's just that it's so easy to have it get you out of control and to build up government. Its nature is to make bigger government, and that's what the problem is. That's why there's a lot of, quote-unquote, very conservative Republicans and some libertarians who don't like Mitt Romney. They think he's not the guy to be president, but then again, you look at the alternative, it isn't very good. Yeah, you can vote for the Jerry, whatever his name, for the Libertarian Party, but you know what? That's not going to help. I mean, you'll be in a closet with a few other people. It's not going to help because Obama's going to be president for 4 more years if you do that. All right, so limiting government is required if you're going to have a free society. The way to limit government is to have a flat tax that is so low that government cannot grow beyond about 10% of gross national product. That's it. That's the size of your government. Can't be more than that. And that includes defense except in periods of active, declared war. So if you've got those kinds of situations, or something else, like an asteroid hits the center of the United States or something, or at Yellowstone Park, the whole park is founded on a fortunate volcano, a very dangerous kind of volcano, and the volcano starts to erupt. Well, we might want to increase government for a short time if those kinds of things take place. But that can be done. That you can make an amendment or a constitution, or however you want to look at it, that says government generally cannot be greater than 10% of the gross national product. It cannot tax the people at a greater rate than that. And with the exceptions of blank, blank, and the following. And it has to be declared by Congress, and it has to be approved by the blank, blank of the House, and the rest. And so that's it. Other than that, you got to have government working at that, and government cannot borrow more money. It has to always have a balanced budget, because it can't ever exceed 10% of the gross national product, no matter what. And so this is right there. Right at the very beginning of our new amendments, we've made a huge dent in limiting government. Now, some people are going to say, well, wait a second. You need 19 or 20% to maintain government at the same levels that it was under Bush or this guy or that guy. Well, you know what? You don't. You don't need half of the government we had. That's the problem. You need about half. Maybe a little less, but no more. And so that's all we need. Now, why do I say that? Because most of the government has some waste in it. Some of the government is obviously way over-limiting us, and it's making rules, et cetera. Now, this doesn't even count the Obama stuff. Obama is, that's just tyranny. The number of rules they've made with executive orders on top of it, the whole thing is just the beginnings, maybe even beyond the beginning, of a communist state. That's what we're really dealing with. But that's hopefully going to go away. And if it doesn't, then a few years from now, you'll all be saying, well, I wish we had listened to that guy on the radio, because, yeah, here it is. Okay, you'll find out. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And I won't be on, probably, because this, what I'm saying right now will be declared illegal by some executive order. So here you've got this kind of problem. The solution is so obviously, it's almost silly how simple it is. And just say to yourself, well, then what about the progressive thing? Well, that goes away, and we have a flat tax. The flat tax is not a VAR. That's another crazy thing, because that's a tax on a tax on a tax. That's really out of control. The flat tax is just like, okay, you're going to pay X percent, 15% of all income is going to go that way. And because capital gains taxes are based upon taxing people for risky operations, that is based upon asset value, which makes no sense, shouldn't tax that at all, we'll make that 5% to allow some people to feel better that people who make most of their money through capital gains have to pay some tax. And I agree with that. I'm not against that, honestly. Even though there's some illogic about it, because it isn't, I don't know how you get away with claiming that it's okay to tax risk and assets. But if you want to believe that that's okay, fine, then we'll go. Just to get to this system, I would gladly do that. I'd even go maybe as high as 10% if it really quelled all the other people and we could get a flat tax going. We would eventually find that as you lower the capital gains tax, you increase people's collection of equity and you improve the amount of risk that we're willing to take, so the society grows much faster. But that's a whole other issue that needs to be experimented with, because some people will disagree with me, of course. And then, so that's the First Amendment, First New Amendment to our new constitution. Doesn't sound like much, I know, but it's huge. Nothing will do more to limit government than that as the First New Amendment. That's a biggie. Okay, the next thing I would suggest, because we have so much corruption, and corruption is eating us away. It's worse right now than ever, because part of a communist regime, before it really is communist, is based upon the need to corrupt itself in order to control itself. So corruption is a means to an end. And so to get rid of the corruption, several things I suggest. First, limit the terms in which people can be holding office. And I already suggested these, and there's a lot of possible answers to this question. But why limit terms? Why not just let the people vote? Well, the problem with that gets back to what I said in the beginning of the show. It's the difference between democracy and republics, and why if you don't have limiting terms, you ultimately allow too much of the democratic issues to intervene, and less of the minorities are represented in the will of the representatives. If you want to keep more of the minorities represented, and I don't care if you're a gay person or you're this or that person, it's going to be to your benefit to have term limits, because the minority views will become better represented, the majority will not bully people as easily, and the government will become more responsive to the will of the people. And so I suggested maybe three terms for people in the House of Representatives, the two terms for senators, two terms for the people, for the president. I think that it's potentially the best thing to keep the lifelong term of our Supreme Court justices, but I would make it in the Constitution that they must follow the existing Constitution as it is written, which is called original thought, originalism, in comparison to those who are going to creatively change the Constitution based upon new circumstances. Well, if there are new circumstances, it's up to Congress and the people to initiate laws, not the Supreme Court. And so I would take that more conservative viewpoint, which that's called a conservative viewpoint, in enforcing the Supreme Court, actually make it into part of this amendment. And then and if a Supreme Court justice in three decisions or more follows a pattern of breaking that principle, they are replaced. That's it. They're done. And you do it twice, get away with it. Third time, you're done. And you just get replaced, that's all. You've served maybe a year, 20 years, whatever you served, and you're done. And so and the president will pick a new person, and the Congress will, the Senate will choose whether or not that person is going to be. Okay, so we now go to some of the more, we'll say, specific issues that I talked about at the beginning of the show. Should the government have a right to determine that there's a special class of people called, by our standards today, married, legally married? And we're going to encourage legal marriage because it makes the whole society better, and people are responsible for children, they're responsible for each other, and they live more as a unit than as an individual, which helps them to discover the nature of the soul. We like that. We think that makes for a better, more virtuous society. My suggestion is we get rid of legal marriage, totally get rid of it, and all of what we used to call legal marriages are now legal civil unions. That's it. The government only issues legal civil unions to all persons. I don't care if they're gay or different, they're from different planets. If two people want to be union civil marriages, you know, they got it from the government, and they get a little piece of paper that says, we encourage you to have these rights and responsibilities, which has to do with children, it has to do with property, has to do with inheritances, has to do with various other issues, including, but not infiltrating the issue of taxation, because taxation now is going to be flat. So being married is not going to be a necessary advantage except for the following. You can average incomes between two people, which may, in some circumstances, depending upon how you apply the issues, what I said earlier about capital gains and other things, there may be some advantages to some people who get married on a civil basis. But it's not marriage. I don't want to even use that word. Everybody is getting civil union. Okay? That's your legal standing. Now, if you want to get married, you can do so. And getting married is a religious or spiritual, depending, for some people they call it religious, other people call it spiritual, factor, because they want to get, quote-unquote, unionized by something other than the government for the practical purposes that the government has, and those people can do so any place they find the right place that they can do it in, which could be their church or synagogue or whatever they want to go to, or they can do it in front of other special people who have, by their standards, certain spiritual reasons that they can be introduced into their form of marriage. And all gay people can go to any place and any person's not gay, except it's up to those places to determine who they want to convey their marriage on. So some places probably won't want gay people, but a lot of other places will. And gay people can start their own kinds of religions if they want, and everybody's happy because everybody has a civil union, and nobody has a government-sponsored marriage. Now, you're probably scratching your head and saying, that sounds like it might work. Why didn't we think of that before? I don't know. Don't ask me. I'm just coming up with the ideas here. It should work, yeah, because that would solve the problem, right? Now, you are going to have a Defense of Marriage Act, no more DOMA or whatever you would call it, because you don't need it. The government should not be saying who has the right to be spiritually married or not. And everybody has the right. Everybody should have the same rights in terms of the government. They should. There should not be winners and losers or ups and downs or anything, because the present Defense of Marriage Act is prejudicial. Why is it prejudicial? Because it says that only a man and a woman can be legally married. Well, that's not fair, because there's legal benefits and rewards. Well, some people say, well, we'll call it legal marriage for some, and other people will call it civil marriage. Well, that doesn't work, because then you're still not in the same class of everybody else based upon how the government sees you. It's not the same thing. If you really want to have the same thing, everybody just has a civil union contract with the government, giving them certain privileges and rights and certain responsibilities. That's fine. That's all. And everyone's got the same deal. And then if you want to get spiritually married, you go to whoever you feel is the spiritual person or people to do that, and you do it. And now you don't have any more of this craziness that we've got going on, even today, with chicken love and chicken flavor or whoever they're going. I mean, it's nuts stuff. I mean, like, we don't have some really serious problems. We have to get into this area of people's lives. Now, I want you to understand something. I think the people who have gay issues in their life, who pursue homosexuality, either because they think it's great for themselves or because they just feel that that's who they are and what they want to be, or can't change it or whatever they want, I think they have a disadvantage. And the disadvantage is, based upon principles in ancient wisdom, those principles state, and it's too complicated for me to explain this evening, I'd have to do a whole show on it to explain how it works, that during the sexual act itself, people who are of the same sex cannot express what we call love, we being people who understand principles in ancient wisdom. That doesn't mean that they don't love each other. It doesn't mean they can't express love in a million other ways. It's just through the sexual act that it is impossible to do it, and that's because it has to do with two people being of different sexes to accomplish that goal. Forget about that being some kind of evil or bad thing about people. That is not what I'm saying. I'm just saying among themselves, they have their own issue. Does it affect children? Sure. The child may recognize that and have some problems. problems with it. Do I have a solution for it? Not exactly, no. Because I don't think that people who are homosexual should be barred from being able to adopt children. I don't. But I do recognize the rights of children to be able to sense or understand that possibly, if this is true, in the principles of ageless wisdom, when their parents are having sex, they can't express love to each other, and they may feel that in some way. That may make them in some way have a bad response to sexuality or something like that. I've written about this in a couple of different articles and books and stuff. The thing about it is that that's something the homosexual people can't themselves figure out solutions to, and government should absolutely not have anything to do with it. Period. I mean, that's their own issue. Now you say, well, whoa, it's going to badly affect the children. It's going to affect them in some negative way in some circumstances. It may not affect them at all, except to the kid, to some extent. But also, what if the parents say, well, you know, here's the situation. We are homosexual, and when, according to the principles of angels' wisdom, which may not be true, by the way, but we think we've heard about them, and maybe we do believe in them, it's harder for us, or we can't express a love during our sexual activities. Just during that time. We can't any other time, but during that time. And it's a big deal. It really is a big deal. But the point is that we want you to know about that so that you know that that's a limitation. And that's a problem we have. Lots of people have all kinds of habits and other issues they do. They live their lives, and they can be open and explain those same things to their children as well. That doesn't mean their children are going to automatically fall off the planet because of it. But it may mean that they have problems. That is not the government's role to say, well, gee, we're going to make sure all kids eat this or have that or have only these kinds of parents. That's ridiculous. Under no circumstance will a limited government ever be involved in such craziness. So, what am I suggesting? Well, education is good. But should education involve telling people that homosexuality is good or bad? I don't think so. I don't think so. But the most important thing is it should not involve telling people it's good either. It should be promoting either. Because education, just like government, is being the two parts of God's thought in a spiritual sense. If it's truly spiritual, it's open-minded. It allows people to figure out for themselves what way they want to live. It should not promote homosexuality, because if it does, it's as bad as the other side, those who condemn homosexuality. This is an interesting and serious problem, because today we're having real struggles. Can we solve these problems? Oh, sure. They are definitely solvable. Should people in the military be forced to live together and to bathe together, do all those other things, if they're in the presence of homosexuals? And the answer to that question is simple as all get out. If you're going to do that, then you have to allow men and women in the military who are heterosexual to live together freely. And to shower together and everything else. If that's okay with everybody, then it's just as okay to allow people who are homosexual to do that with heterosexual people or other homosexual people. It's up to us to determine that as what we think. Now, the military is not civil. Remember that. Military has to do with security and protection first, civil issues become secondary. So there can be special circumstances which civil rights are not exercised in the military. However, what I'm suggesting is if it's good for the goose, so to speak, it's good for all of us. So we have to really look at this as a serious issue. And that would be my way of solving the problem, is to say whatever we're going to adopt, it's going to be the same for everybody. And no, we're not going to have don't ask, don't tell, if we're going to have don't ask, don't tell for heterosexuals, living together them. You should be completely open. Now, a lot of people might say, well, what's wrong with that? And maybe nothing. Maybe it's okay for everybody to have sex with anybody and everybody that they want to have sex with, whether they're in the military or not. Could be true. Now, why has that traditionally not been the case? Well, in the past, it wasn't the case. But I don't think the past is applying as much these days, because the males of the military would become unduly attached to any females around them. So they weren't supposed to have close contacts that were sexual, intimate, because you would have a preferential desire and treatment that might go against orders and things to protect someone that you had such an interest in. That was the problem, right? So that's something to consider. That's not the only problem. And that was for usually women who weren't even in military, or weren't in the military per se, they might have been nurses, etc. Now it's the women directly in the military, but and they even take combat roles sometimes, so the whole thing has changed. So now we have to look at it from a different standpoint. So on that score, I say the same thing. You know, it's time for us to really reconsider all of these factors. Again, this may not deal so much with government, because the military is a very special circumstance where civil rights are really not part of the issue. I mean, you try to still have some civil rights if it's possible, but it isn't required, and they give up their civil rights when they enter the military. So something to consider. Now, what about things like abortion? Well, again, anything about abortion or reproductive rights should have nothing to do with the government, period. I'm telling you, nothing. Is it murder to kill a zygote? It's an egg, a fertilized egg. No, in my opinion, principles of ancient wisdom say no. When does that egg eventually divide enough times to become functional as a living being? Not functional just from staying in the abdomen of a woman or under special circumstances of certain kinds of equipment, but when is it really functional? And that's after the first trimester, a few weeks at minimum, and until that point has been reached, which is maybe a moving target, depending upon certain issues in technology, et cetera. But it's pretty close. It's going to remain fairly close to the same time. Until that time is reached, I do not believe the government should have anything to say about what people do or don't do to that first egg, fertilized egg, and eventually fetus. And I know, you know, some people are going to say, oh, God, what is he saying? I thought this guy is very spiritual. You kill a fetus. Well, as much as I don't care for that, necessarily, in the principles of ancient wisdom, there's no person there. For there to be a person, you have to have enough of what is known as the personality. The personality doesn't form until several weeks after the first trimester, but really, actually more than a month. So it isn't a right or fair principle to say that you're killing a person. And, you know, that's just the way it is. Now, if you don't believe in killing anything, it's your prerogative to say, well, then I can't do that and whatever. But that isn't something for me to say or anyone to say about others' rights to live their life as they choose. And as far as, you know, people being able to use contraception, that's just ridiculous to me. But, you know, if you believe contraception does prevent, you know, there eventually being human beings, and you see that there's a clear connection there, you can voice that. That's okay. But the government should not be used in any respect in limiting that. I don't care if it's the morning after, before, never, ever, whatever. Pill or this or that, it doesn't make any difference to me, because the government shouldn't be involved in limiting that about anybody. So what about people who have an abortion after 21 weeks or 22 weeks or something? Then that's a real problem, because there's a good chance that is a person. It could live outside of the mother. Should the government get involved in protecting the rights of a person, an unborn person? Probably, yeah. I say this probably. Reluctantly, because I know that, you know, it still seems to people who want to have control over their own bodies, why shouldn't I be able to kill the living thing inside me? Well, if you haven't done it after 21 weeks, what's wrong with you in the first place? Like, but, you know, there's young people who don't even know they're pregnant. They get confused. They deny that this or that. And they can go through 21 weeks like we didn't even, you know, like nothing. And suddenly they're going to have to have a birth and a child. Well, in those circumstances, the best thing is government, if it does take the freedom away from us, should take responsibility for the child itself. Make sure that the person is not forced at least to raise that child or even to pay for raising that child, because the freedom is being removed by the government itself and saying, hey, this is a person, you can't do that. So what I'm saying is government should not force people to be parents who don't want to be parents, because that's not a good thing. What about paying for them? You know, it's a toss-up. Maybe on a case-by-case basis. Certainly you got to take some responsibility, but what happens if it happens to a 12- or a 13-year-old? They can get pregnant. Did they really have the consciousness to understand what they were doing well enough so for the next 18 years of their life, they have to pay for the child, and worse yet, no, I would never go on with this, but be a parent to it? That doesn't ring true to me, and so I say case by case. If the person is 25, it's a big difference to me than if they're half that age. You know, I just have to look at it from another viewpoint. So that could be a much more complex law, but generally the government doesn't get involved at all. Only under these exceptions. Remember the exception rule about principles and ancient wisdom. There are a lot of them. Just because we have general principles that work most of the time, that doesn't mean the exception should not be observed and dealt with. You might spend a lot more time and energy dealing with the exceptions than you deal with the real issue. That's okay. That's permitted. That's reasonable, as a matter of fact. If government's going to do anything, and a good way to limit government is for it to spend the time on the exceptions, then it can't do much to the rest of us. It's too busy with the exception. That's fine with me. All right. What about the death penalty? Should we put people to death? Generally speaking, the answer to that is no. Now, why do I say that? Because principles and ancient wisdom say that human beings are not wise enough on a collective basis to determine the life and death of others. There are a few that are. They are people who are called advanced third-level initiates in our huts. But there's too few of them around, and they're not certainly doing that job very well, because that's not what they're here for anyway. So generally speaking, our system has mostly average folks determining these sentences. And even the judges that supposedly have so much more wisdom, they don't. So too many people have been put to death who are either innocent or not correctly charged with the nature of the crime that supposedly led them to die. And this is the wrong thing. One person dying is a cruel, cruel situation who should never have been put to death because of mistakes in the system. Look how many people who are alive still that are being released from prison. Someone who's today, I just heard it on the news, who never committed the crime in the first place, much less that the circumstances of the crime were not fully understood. That's even greater. So, this is a mess. Putting people to death is final. And it's expensive to keep people alive. I understand that. But let's work on dealing with those who are charged with death penalty crimes in other ways that is commensurate with the crime and gives them an opportunity to change. That doesn't mean they're going to necessarily be walking around free people, but to contribute something back even while they're in prison, to make their life meaningful, but also to change them, because they're going to be back someday, according to the principles and ageless wisdom. And since they're coming back, killing them doesn't do us any good at all. They come back to the same position, they deal with the same issues, and they're going on to the next world, where people, when they're killed, you should know this, I want you to understand it, if they're killed for not good enough reason, and for no reason at all, because they didn't commit the crime, those people have a terrible time in the astral world. And they're open victims for the dark side. The dark side can grab them, and they can become really evil. Because they're so insulted, they're so demoralized, that their life was taken from them by those who aren't following God. And so they turn against God. I hope you understand what I'm saying. It's very dangerous. It increases the evil in the world. It makes things quite complicated and problematic for all of us. So it isn't worth killing people. It just ain't worth it. Too many problems, no real gain. Now, on an emotional level, there's a lot of times where I like to say, oh, I kill that person. I say it all the time sometimes. And I come up and say, oh, that person's dead. But I know that it doesn't work. I mean, the wise part of me, not the emotional part, the guy who says, oh, son of a bitch. Now, I'm saying it doesn't work. And if we're really applying principles of angel's wisdom, which is what this show is about, we have to look at the truth, or beyond the truth, to wisdom. Okay. So I think I want to close today. Oh, I got 2 minutes left. This is ridiculous. I want to close today's show by just saying I hope this could be a lot longer show. We could have done a lot more with it, but I hope that what I did explain, I want to go in a couple more amendments that I did cover, but I hope today's show has given you some pause, has given you some idea of how limited government is much better government, and how what we're moving towards, if we reelect the present administration, especially the president himself, is going to be the exact opposite. It's going to be hell right here on earth. So please think about everything I'm saying. You don't have to say, oh, I'm going to buy this guy 100% or whatever. Just listen to tonight's show again, maybe, with an open mind. Especially if you're, you know, a staunch liberal Democrat. Think about everything I said. Check out the facts that I brought into tonight. And read more about history and other stuff. And see if it isn't all there, like I said it was. Well, I hope this has really made a difference. I don't know what else to say, because we are out of the time I would like to cover about so many other areas that would make more sense to make some changes and to do better things. You can think of them yourself. If you want, you can email me some ideas. Not to say that I know them or don't know them. I would love to hear from you about what ideas you have. And if you don't like some of the stuff I said tonight, that's okay. Let me know about it. I don't mind. Okay, well, we are out of time, and until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.